Good evening, everyone. Before we get into this evening's lesson, I would like to remind everyone to make plans to stick around for a few minutes after the service this evening. We'll have a congregational meeting, as we mentioned this morning. I would also like to request that if you picked up a copy of the three-page document on the way in, that you not read that during the sermon, because we'll be covering at least a portion of that in the congregational meeting afterwards. So that's just for your future reference. In the meantime, turn to the Gospel of John, chapter 5. We're going to read the first 15 verses of this chapter. This is the story of the healing of the lame man by the pool of Bethesda. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, lame, blind, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. And by the way, I'll just mention some of you reading more modern translations. We'll notice that verse 4 and the last phrase of verse 3 are probably not in your text, or they're bracketed or something, as indicating that they were probably not part of the original text. However, if you'll glance down at verse 7, which we'll be reading shortly, verse 4 helps explain verse 7. So we won't say anything further about that potential problem. But picking up again at verse 5, now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he already had been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed, and walk." And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed, and walked. And that day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said to him who was cured, "It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed." He answered them, "He who made me well said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" Then they asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, a multitude being in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you." The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. Now, throughout the career of Jesus in the four Gospels, we read of many miracles that he performed. And I think we would all have to say that as miracles go, and I recognize any miracle is an extraordinary event, especially to the one who received it, but as the miracles of Jesus go, just looking at the whole span of them, this is what you would call a minor miracle. It's not all that spectacular, again, as miracles go. I can think of many other miracles that Jesus performed that are a lot more spectacular, a lot more attention-grabbing than this one was. Think of the raising of Lazarus from the dead or the feeding of the 5,000. There are any number of things that Jesus did that made a much bigger splash than this one did. However, the thing that makes this one really stand out is not so much the miracle itself or the details of the miracle as it is the aftermath. As you read the rest of chapter 5, it's obvious that this miracle caused quite an uproar among Jesus' critics. And the thing that really stands out, as we'll get into greater detail later in the lesson, is that when you keep reading through the Gospel of John, this miracle crops up again in chapter 7. And we'll trace through the timing of this. There was about a year that transpired between these two chapters. And still people were talking about it and criticizing Jesus for it. So there was something unique about this miracle that made it special and something that John wanted to preserve for posterity in his gospel. Our purpose here this evening is not to analyze the miracle itself, Our purpose is not to analyze all of the argumentation or dissect the logic that Jesus uses. We'll be talking about a portion of that. But there are big chunks of what Jesus said in chapter 5 that we're just going to pass over. What we want to do this evening with this miracle, or more precisely with the aftermath of the miracle, is to extract a lesson that we can learn from this story that Jesus teaches us about why people refuse to believe in Him. Remember, the Gospel of John was written in order that people might believe that He was the Christ, the Son of God. But yet, the Gospel also informs us quite clearly there are a lot of people who did not believe Him. They did not accept the claims that Jesus made for Himself. And this is one of those stories where, despite the miracle, despite the debate that Jesus engaged in with these people, they just refused to accept who He claimed to be. And in exploring that lesson, I think we will find some insight into how we ought to deal with people today, particularly those who are not of a frame of mind to accept the gospel that we're trying to teach them. So first, let's spend some time setting up the background here for this miracle. Understand the setting. What's going on here? The first thing we want to notice is the occasion. If you look in verse 1 again, it just simply says that there was a feast of the Jews. Now, this is rather unusual in the Gospel of John. There are three occasions in the Gospel of John where he specifies, actually there's more than that, but three I'm thinking of in particular, in which he specifies that it was the Passover feast, not on this occasion, but on other occasions. A Passover feast of the Jews was near, and this and that happened. But for some reason, in chapter 5, he just refers ambiguously to a feast of the Jews. Now, some commentators will argue that this is another Passover. I find that a little difficult because everywhere else where the Passover feast comes up, John makes specific reference to it. Why would he leave it out here? There's a pretty strong implication this was not the Passover feast. Some argue it's the Feast of Tabernacles, sometime around the month of October. Probably the best explanation that I have seen is that it is probably the Feast of Trumpets. That was in late September or early October. And the significance of that will be seen later on. Normally, we would not spend any time talking about the minutia of these Jewish feast days and the timing and the dates and all of that. That normally wouldn't be of much attention to us, but in this particular case it is important. And we'll notice as we get deeper into the lesson why it is important. Another detail here that is critical to what is happening is the location. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, what we call the Synoptic Gospels, devote most of their attention to the work that Jesus was doing in the province of Galilee, which is north of Judea and Jerusalem. It was kind of a backwater of Jewish society. Poor people lived there. We would call it the boonies today. But that's the location where Jesus did much of His work. And again, the three first Gospels devote much of their attention to the work that He did in Galilee and say very little about what He did in Jerusalem. John's gospel flips that model on its head and says very little about what Jesus did in Galilee and instead devotes most of his attention to what Jesus was doing in Jerusalem. And that's where this miracle took place. You'll notice again in verse 2 that there is in Jerusalem this pool called Bethesda. So this is in the city of Jerusalem, almost within the shadow of the temple itself, where this miracle is taking place. Now that explains a lot about the aftermath to the miracle. Jesus is performing this miracle almost under the very noses of the Jewish aristocracy, the ruling class of the Jewish nation. Now it's one thing for Him to be way off in Galilee performing these miracles and arousing the rabble. That's one thing. They could live with that. But for Him to come into the holy precinct itself, the holy city, and start performing these miracles and creating an uproar there, that's intolerable. And that's why this miracle, along with a few others that John records taking place in the city of Jerusalem, create such an outcry among his critics. And they attack him viciously because of what he has done. Look, if you will, at verses 16 through 18. We stopped reading at verse 15 at the conclusion of the miracle proper, but look now at the reaction of the Jews beginning in verse 16. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Two complaints they had about Jesus. The first was that he performed this miracle on the Sabbath day. Now, again, we read other places in the other Gospels of Jesus performing a miracle on the Sabbath day, and he was criticized for that, but not to the point of trying to kill him. We're dealing with a different group of people here than the kind of critics that he was dealing with in Galilee. These people mean business. And they see Jesus as a very direct threat to their position, to their authority, to their power. And for Jesus now to challenge their interpretation of the Sabbath law right under their noses, right there in Jerusalem itself, is just intolerable. They cannot accept this. And so they immediately decide that they're going to have to eliminate this guy. And the debate doesn't even get started before they pounce on another thing that Jesus did, and that is to call God his Father. So all the more they're seeking to kill him, because in calling God his Father, he is more or less making himself equal with God. He is an offspring, a descendant of God. As such, it's blasphemy. And so he deserves to die. And so, for all the more reason now, they want to kill him. So this makes it pretty serious, doesn't it? They really have it in for Jesus now, more than any other miracle he has performed to this point. And again, what makes this one so different is not the nature of the miracle itself. Again, this is a grade B miracle if you want to start assigning values to them. It's just not that big a deal as far as his miracles are concerned. But the place that he did it, and the time that he did it, and the claim he made for himself in doing it is the kind of thing that makes it such a big deal. These people are determined to eliminate Jesus because of what he has done, and where he has done it, and when he has done it. And so the rest of chapter 5 is Jesus' response to their attacks on him. He's defending himself in a fashion, and we're going to be looking at some details in the rest of chapter 5. But before we descend into the details of what he's saying in chapter 5, I'd like for us to just spend a moment and look ahead, just take a sneak peek at what happens over the next couple of chapters. Now look in chapter 6 in verse 4. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Now at this time, he's back up in Galilee, verse 1. And here we have in chapter 6 the story of the feeding of the 5,000. This is one of the few cases where John records the same miracle that the other three Gospels record. We won't go into the detail of what happened there. This is the place where the Galilean campaign basically collapsed. All of his disciples, or most of them, could not figure out what he was talking about, of eating his flesh and drinking his blood, and this guy's nuts, and they just walked away, and leaving pretty much just the apostles to still be following Jesus. But the thing I want to notice is the timing, the Passover. Well, now, if the feast of chapter 5 was the feast of trumpets in late September, early October, for Passover to come in chapter 6, that's a full 6 months. So imagine 6 months have passed, and then we read the events of chapter 6, and then hold that thought and go into chapter 7. In verse 2, we're told that the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. And here Jesus goes to Jerusalem again for this feast. Well, Feast of Tabernacles is in October. So in chapter 5, we're reading of something that takes place in September, October of 1 year. In chapter 6, 6 months have passed. We're now in April the following year. In chapter 7, we're down to October of that second year. A full year has gone by between chapter 5 and chapter 7. Now hold that thought and look at in chapter 7, beginning in verse 21. A debate breaks out with his critics. And notice what he says. Jesus answered and said to them, I did one work, and you all marvel. Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. What miracle, what one work is he referring to? The one where he made a man completely well on the Sabbath? The one that was described in chapter 5? The one that happened a year earlier? These people have long memories. And again, with all the miracles that Jesus performed that we're familiar with, he was just performing miracles left and right, we think. Well, that may have been the case in Galilee, but this is different. This is in Jerusalem. He performed very few miracles in Jerusalem. This one got the attention of the authorities. And so he has performed this miracle in the fall of 1 year, and 1 year later, the people are still talking about it. They're still criticizing him for it. He's still having to defend himself over what he did a year earlier. Now, as I said, that's what makes this miracle as common and ordinary, quote unquote, as we would consider it to be. That's what makes it so unique, so worthy of our attention. But let's go back to chapter 5 now, and let's look at what Jesus says in presenting evidence for the validity of his claim. Now, again, we're not going to try to go through and look at everything that Jesus said from about verse 19 through the end of the chapter. What we're going to do is skim through the last few verses of the chapter, beginning about in verse 31. From verse 31 to the end of the chapter, Jesus lays out a series of proofs, if you will, or evidence, supporting his claim of who he is. And let's notice these things, if you will. The first one that he points to in verse 31 is himself. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. Now, you have to stop and think about this one for a little bit. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. Is Jesus holding out the possibility here that his claims are not valid? No. What he's doing is simply recognizing the principle of self-evidential evidence that's laid out in the law of Moses, namely that a man's evidence or testimony concerning himself doesn't carry any weight. And that's basically true in our own system of jurisprudence today. A man can certainly make a claim for himself, but that is not admissible as evidence. It doesn't prove anything. Anybody can stand up and say anything, make any kind of outrageous claim about themselves, and it doesn't prove anything. Because obviously they have a lot of self-interest at stake, right? That's all Jesus is saying here in verse 31. I can bear witness to myself. I can claim that I'm the Son of God, that God is my Father. And Jesus is acknowledging, I understand why you don't accept that. That doesn't carry a lot of weight. So he just mentions that and moves on. And then look, beginning in verse 33, you have sent to John, he's referring to John the Baptist, and he has borne witness to the truth, yet I do not receive testimony from man, but I say these things that you may be saved. He was the burning and shining lamp, and you were willing for a time to rejoice in his light. Now notice his statement here that these men were willing for a time to rejoice in his light. He's not saying that these critics of his were disciples of John the Baptist. They were no such thing. However, they did accept Jesus, accept John the Baptist as at least a curiosity, perhaps a celebrity, one of these eccentric country preachers that kind of reminded them of the prophets of old and they kind of enjoyed sitting back and watching this country hick and listening to all the things, outrageous things that he was saying. And it's to that extent that Jesus would say that they were willing for a time to rejoice in his light. They could cut John the Baptist some slack and give him a little bit of credit. As you know, they never did raise a finger against John the Baptist because they knew he was so popular among the people. And they just kind of went along with the game. They played it along with everybody else. They weren't just really great advocates of John the Baptist. And Jesus recognizes that. And whereas he acknowledges that they had some kind of affection for John the Baptist, he still says in verse 34, I do not receive testimony from man. In other words, I'm not going to place a lot of stock on the testimony of John the Baptist. I think John the Baptist was a prophet of God, and what he spoke was the truth, especially the truth concerning me. But I'm not going to lean on that. That's not my primary source of evidence for who I am and my relationship to God. What then does he lean upon? In verse 32, he drops a hint. There is another who bears witness of me, and I know that the witness which he witnesses of me is true. And he picks up that thought again in verse 36. I have a greater witness than John's. And now he describes who that witness is and how that witness has testified concerning him. Two things. For the works which the Father has given me to finish, the very works that I do, bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. And the Father himself who sent me has testified of me. You have neither heard his voice at any time nor seen his form, but you do not have his word abiding in you, because whom he sent, him you do not believe. You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they which testify of me. Two things, he says, the Father has used to bear testimony to Jesus. The first is the works that Jesus performed, the works which the Father has given me to finish. Those very works, he says, bear witness of me that the Father sent me. Remember back in chapter 3 of the Gospel of John, when Nicodemus, the ruler of the Jews, came to Jesus by night, and he said, no man can do the things that you do, these signs that you do, except he be from God. He got it. Now, he wasn't going to go public with it, but at least to Jesus in the darkness of night, he was willing to admit, nobody can do what you're doing unless they're from God. There was something really remarkable about this man. He had to be from God to be able to do the things that he was doing. But the second thing, the second way in which Jesus says the Father was testifying of Jesus was through the Scriptures. Now, to you and I, that's no big deal. We're well familiar, I suspect, with all of the Old Testament prophecies and the promises and the types and antitypes and so forth that spell out in many cases in great detail the work that Jesus was going to be doing. And Jesus acknowledges the fact that these folks, these critics of his, in verse 39, you search the Scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they which testify of me. If they're really searching their Scriptures, honestly and openly, as they ought to be, they're going to recognize some things in those Scriptures that are being fulfilled by Jesus. Now, we won't take the time to chase that rabbit trail and all the different particulars in which the Old Testament spoke of and identified the coming of the Christ. But we'll just leave it with that, that these were the two forms of witness that the Father was bearing of Jesus. But, and this really gets to the crux of this evening's lesson, Jesus also here in these last few verses in chapter 5 not only tells these people of the evidence for the validity of his claims, he also spells out to them three reasons why they're not believing them, why they're not accepting the evidence that has been laid out. And that's what I'd like to consider here for the next few minutes. First of all, look in verse 42. Jesus says, but I know you, that you do not have the love of God in you. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive. How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from the only God? Now I'll summarize these three verses under the moniker of misplaced affections. You'll notice that Jesus says they prefer the honor of one another and not the honor that comes from God. They're more concerned about what men think of them than they are what God thinks of them. And then look in verse 39. Again, we referred earlier to the fact that they're searching the Scriptures. They think in these Scriptures they're going to find eternal life, which is nominally correct, but they're not really taking those Scriptures seriously. Jump down and begin reading in verse 45. Do not think that I shall accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. And he is the author, of course, of the first five books of those Scriptures that they are so diligently searching. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? You notice an irony here? Jesus says concerning these people that you trust Moses, verse 45. Moses in whom you trust. They put all their confidence and trust. You ask any of these guys, what do they think of Moses? Oh, he's the founder of our religion. He's the greatest prophet that God has ever sent. If it weren't for Moses, we would not have these grand scriptures by which we can know how we ought to order our steps before God. Oh, they just put Moses up on the highest pedestal. They trust him. And yet, what does Jesus say about their treatment of the scriptures that Moses has given them? If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? The strong implication is there, oh, you honor Moses, but you don't believe what he's written. You won't accept the prophecies that he made concerning me and how my life and my work is the fulfillment of everything that Moses talked about. So with their mouth, they honor Moses, the prophet of God. But with their lives, with their actions, with their behavior, they deny the very scriptures that Moses wrote. So if that's the case, how are they going to believe anything that Jesus says? So they have abused the scriptures that God has given them. There's one more, though, that I've deliberately skipped that I wanted to go back and check now. And look at verse 40. This is the one that really, I think, encapsulates the whole problem with these people. Look at verse 40 carefully. But you are not willing to come to me that you may have life. You know, everything else that Jesus says in his response to his critics on this occasion really just falls away in light of the truth that Jesus relays here in verse 40. You are not willing to come to me. The reason that you won't believe me and my claims, because you don't want to. Have you ever had a kid, one of your own, who when you sit down at the supper table, you tell them to eat their peas, and the kid just sits there and crosses his arms and looks at you and glares and refuses to lift a spoon? What's going on there? It's a battle of the wills, isn't it? Who's going to win? The kid has drawn a line in the sand and is daring you to cross it. The kid is not going to eat his peas. Why? He doesn't want to. And you can't reason with a child in that situation. It's going to be a battle royal. And you just have to stick with it until the kid finally learns who's ruling the roost here, and it's not him. But that's what these people are doing. That's what Jesus is accusing them of. Now, we can call this prejudice. We can call it self-will. We can call it stubbornness. We can call it pride. There's any number of labels that we can stick on this to describe why these people are rejecting the claims of Jesus, but he pretty well sums it up here. It's a matter of will. They do not want to believe him. What can Jesus say or do beyond what he's already said or done to convince them to change their minds? If they do not want to believe it, there's not much that he's going to be able to do. We spent the time earlier establishing the timeline between chapters 5, 6, and 7, but jump ahead to chapter 7 again. And remember, we're jumping out 1 year in time. A lot has happened in that intervening year in the lives of all the people that are involved. But now 1 year later, when Jesus comes back and this whole issue is brought up again and the debate renews with increased ferocity, notice what Jesus says in verse 16, chapter 7. He answered and said to them, "My doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me." Look at verse 17. "If anyone wills to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine, whether it is from God or whether I speak on my own authority." What did he say? If anybody wants to know, they can figure this out. What's the implication there? If somebody doesn't believe, it's not for lack of evidence. It's because they have a stubborn will. Their minds are made up. They're not going to believe. And it doesn't make any difference what Jesus says, what he does. They just do not want to believe. It's exactly the same argument or charge that Jesus made against them 1 year earlier. They haven't forgotten what he did, and he hasn't forgotten them. He knows what he's dealing with here. These are people whose minds are just dug in, and they will not change. They will not accept anything that Jesus says or does as evidence that he is from God. Now then, what does this story tell us today about our attempts to reach the people around us, many of whom do not accept the gospel? You can draw lessons from each of the three things that Jesus said concerning why people back then didn't believe, and draw parallels to the people that we're encountering today. But here's the main lessons, the three lessons that we can draw from this. First of all, we must paint in stark contrast to these people that we're trying to reach, loyalty to men and loyalty to God. That's what got these people in the first century so hung up. They were more concerned, as we said, about receiving honor from their peers. They wanted to be acknowledged and honored and respected among those around them. And as long as that was their primary focus, oh, all of them were saying in unison that we're here to serve God, didn't really mean anything. Because at the end of the day, the thing that was really going to sway the direction that they went was what everybody else around them was doing and believing and what positions they took. And so today, we have people, many people, who are more influenced by personalities and systems and institutions. And those things carry a ton of weight. And people making decisions as to what is right and wrong and what direction they're going to go in their relationship to God. And poor God just has to sit on the sidelines and say, "Hello, I'm over here." And nobody's paying attention. Because we're all concerned about what one another think about us. And that's what we need to concentrate on, is to get people, sometimes even ourselves, to recognize, wait a minute, it doesn't matter what other men think. All that matters is what God thinks. We've got to train ourselves and then help other people to understand that our first loyalty, our first allegiance must always be to God and what He says. And it just doesn't really matter what everybody else believes and thinks and does. But that's such a hard lesson to learn. But it's a lesson that we can draw from what Jesus said about these people. There's a second lesson that we can learn and apply today, and that is that we must promote a respect for the Scriptures as the Word of God. Now, as we noted a moment ago, these people acknowledged the Scriptures as being the source of their relationship with God. They loved to study the Scriptures, and as we said, they put Moses up on a pedestal and the story of all that he did as recorded in the Scriptures. But all that was just for show. That was just a token. It didn't really mean anything. As Jesus pointed out, these very Scriptures that you study are telling you all about me, and you won't believe it. So what does that say about their devotion to the Scriptures as the source of guidance and wisdom from God? It's just for show. It didn't really mean anything. And it's possible for people today to do the same thing, including ourselves. We can say that we honor the Scriptures. We want to follow the Bible. Yes, the Bible is our only source of guidance from God. Is it really? Are we really of the mind that whatever the Scripture says, that's what we're going to do, even if it means it's going to cost us some relationships with other people who don't see it that way? That's a hard bullet to bite. But that's what we've got to train ourselves and then help other people to understand about the role of the Scriptures as, in fact, the final authority that God intends that it be. And then finally, we need to seek to help people replace the prejudice in their hearts with humility. Folks, that's easier said than done. Now you think about that. By far, this is going to be the greatest challenge that is before us because, by definition, a prejudiced heart is not going to change. How do you replace prejudice with humility? You look back at this story here. Over a year's time, Jesus has had two clashes with the same group of people over the same issue, their stubborn self-will. Did Jesus change any of these people? Was he able to purge out the prejudice and the stubbornness and the pride that was driving these people and replace it with a spirit of humility and submission? And yes, we acknowledge we've been wrong and we accept your claims. Never happened. Folks, if the Son of God Himself couldn't do it, what makes you and I think we can do it? Now, I know that we need to try, just as Jesus tried. You never know when there might be some Saul of Tarsus out there that in a moment of clarity will suddenly wake up and recognize, man, I'm on the wrong road, and will make a change. And we need to be there to help that kind of person along. Our task, really, is not to just beat our heads against brick walls, which is basically what we're doing when we're dealing with people like this over and over and over again, when it's clear they're not going to change. Their minds are set in concrete. And we're not going to change them. You know what our task is as children of God today? It's not to change the minds of people like that. It's to go out there and look for the minds that are already humble and honest and submissive and are trying to do the right thing, trying to find God. Those are the people that we are looking for. Our task is to find those honest and humble hearts, not to create them. If Jesus Himself couldn't change those kinds of hard hearts back then, there's a very slim chance we're going to have much luck at it today. But there are some sheep out there. There are some good people who are looking for God. They desperately know that something is better than the life that they're on. And they want to know the truth. Those are the people that we're looking for. And so as we knock on doors, as we talk to people, and as we get the same kind of reaction that Jesus got here, get lost, buzz off, not interested, slam doors, we're going to see it all. Know that you're dealing with the same kind of people that Jesus was dealing with there. And that's okay. Because what we're looking for are the people who are hungering and thirsting for righteousness. People then and people today do not reject the gospel because of a lack of evidence. They reject it because of a lack of humility. And the first question we need to ask ourselves is, do I have an humble heart Am I willing to submit my life, my will, to the will of God? First, foremost, and above everything else. Am I willing to make changes, if necessary, because of what I am seeing of the guidance God's giving me in His Word? If you're in that number this evening, you recognize there are changes you need to make in your life. This is a test of your heart right now. What are you going to do with it? Are you just going to dig in your heels and say, well, no, I'm not really interested. Don't bother me with that. Or are you going to say, God, I surrender. I give up. You're in control here. And whatever you want me to do, that's what I will do. If you need to respond this evening to the Lord's invitation to make the changes in your life that you know you need to make, then why don't you come forward this evening and express your need as together we stand and sing the invitation song.
Thank you.